Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the Nashy Cast. Mm-hmm. We're calling 18.5. Mm-hmm. Well, we're calling
what else would we? Yeah, what
else would we call it? It's the next one. It's 18.5. Yeah, 18, what do you want? Yeah. I'm Rod.
I'm Troy.
But you know that because you've probably listened to more than this one particular
episode. In fact, you notice we're on first name basis now. We're not even throwing out our last names anymore
because
we're all just such good friends.
There's a part of me that wonders if we should have been throwing out our last names ever.
No, it's like because
internet stalkers. I mean, this is the day and age.
Sure, we're on some government list somewhere. You know,
I know we're on a government list or two. But we're here today to introduce a man who probably, if you're listening to this podcast, needs no introduction, but we'll try it anyway. Mm-hmm. We have an interview today with old buddy, a guy we've known for a while, mainly through reading his magazine. Mm-hmm. And in recent times, we've been able to actually be in the same room with him and swap movie stories and talk movie crap with him personally. Yep. His name is Tim Lucas, and he, along with his wife Donna, have for the past 20 years been publishing a little magazine called Video Watchdog. Mm-hmm. Now, if you
little magazine that shook the world, basically.
Yeah, yeah. No
shook the film world anyway, or the film fan world.
I don't see how you could have. I don't see how you could be a fan of Euro horror for any length of time and not come across this magazine, or at least come across Tim's writing some way or another. He
multiple Rondo Award winner and
author of not just a lot of reviews and a lot of feature articles in his own magazine, but all over the web, and possibly his greatest contribution to movie fandom and movie geekdom would have to be his massive, massive, massive book on Mario Bava and his films called All the Colors of the Dark.
Yeah, if you've had the honor of, you know, had the privilege of having your back thrown out by moving this across your room to, you know, it's an amazing
thing.
Book. It is a truly incredible book.
It's a book that I may never actually finish reading every word of because my way to attack the giant book is rewatch a Bava film, rewatch part of a Bava film, a particular one to get it in your head, and then sit down and read the big section of the book.
That's what I do because it's basically like having an extra audio commentary to the book, you know,
it's having a
written commentary for each movie. So that's a good way to go about doing it.
And speaking of commentary tracks, Tim has done a few for a few different Bava films. Danger Diabolic, he did with the film star, John Philip Law. And he's done commentary tracks for a few other Bava films as well. As I've said, throughout the 90s, Video Watchdog was one of the magazines that allowed me kind of a more detailed peek inside a lot of Euro horror films. Mm-hmm. It opened my eyes to a lot of things I was unaware of and made me start clawing my way through bootleggers and magazine articles and everything else I could get my hands on trying to find out more about them. This is not a bad thing. This is a very good thing. It feeds the obsession.
It does.
For God's
it does.
I will admit that Tim Lucas's constant writing about Jess Franco is probably
it's
the reason that I...
It's kind of a blessing and a curse, yeah. I know. I always hate reading that stuff because he makes me want to watch the Franco. He makes me want to watch Jess Franco, and that's a dangerous thing.
Well, I have to admit, I mean, he finally broke me. I finally have found, you know, the groove I can get into with Jess Franco and really find some good films and really enjoy them. But he also wrote a number of reviews about Nashy films in the 90s, throughout the 90s, in Video Watchdog, and it is some of those reviews that led me to seek out certain other films of Nashy's and try to track them down, even though it was hard to do at times.
Yeah.
And so recently when I realized we would have the opportunity to sit down and one-on-one talk with him about Nashy and kind of pick his brain about his movies, his way of writing, his way of looking at things, how he frames the world of monsters, how he looks at monster movies. I just couldn't resist the chance, and luckily Tim had no problem with it, and as you'll find by the end of this interview, really just wanted to keep going because there are a few specific Nashy films that he wanted to talk about more in depth. And so I can say this, we're probably safe in assuming that we'll have another interview.
Yeah, it's probably gonna be a series, an ongoing series.
We'll talk to Tim again probably later this year and have another interview of this type where we'll start off this particular interview talking about Horror Rises from the Tomb instead of leaving it for the very end. You'll notice that, unfortunately, I'm the only one there at this time. That's because Troy had been attacked by groupies.
Yeah, it's well, you know.
And carried off.
You know, I try and go incognito, but, you know, once I get a wind of,
You've got to get a better hat. That hat is no longer as good a disguise as it once was.
Yeah, and I think the Groucho glasses are getting a little worn, too. You know, the nose is getting a little, you know, cracked and worn there, and the mustache is finished, so I've got a new disguise there.
So don't fear that Troy is in the room, but simply in awe of the sheer genius of Tim. Mm.
And just not able to speak.
Right. He wasn't actually there. What I want to do for the next time we sit down and talk with Tim, though, is definitely I want all three of us there.
Yeah, oh yeah. Because I would like that too.
It's always better to have more voices in these kind of things. But I think you're going to enjoy.
I'll just have to check in the hotel under an alias of some kind, and maybe I'll be free from all the ravaging.
I have the perfect idea for a disguise for you, which involves a Bava tattoo on your face. and just on one cheek, you just get, you know, just Bava's face on your cheekbone, on high up on the cheekbone. And we'll discuss
Let's see where we can go with that.
We'll talk to you again later on. This is an interview with Tim Lucas, where we try to stay on topic and talk about Paul Naschy films. We do fail miserably several times, but enjoy, and we'll talk to you again in a little while.
I've got a number of questions. Not that we haven't talked about Paul Naschy before, but it's always kind of fun to get somebody's take, especially somebody who's paid attention to Urahara for as long as you have. One of the first things Troy and I discussed when we started doing this podcast, in the very first podcast, was what was the first Paul Naschy film you saw, if you can remember specifically, and what did you think of it then versus what you think of it now?
Okay. Actually, it goes before the first Naschy film that I saw, to my first exposure to Naschy, which was seeing TV spots for Frankenstein's Bloody Terror when Independent International first released it, I guess, around 1971. This was on WXIX, Channel 19, Cincinnati's first independent television channel. They were about 2 years old at the time, and they had shows on in the afternoon like Ultraman, and they had some anime programs like Prince Planet. And I would come home from school, usually watch Dark Shadows, and then switch over to 19, where they had these fun programs. And it was, I guess, Frankenstein's Bloody Terror was opening that weekend at the local drive-ins, and so they were really heavily saturating the airwaves with these incredible trailers. And I was really fascinated by how amazing the Wolfman looked in this thing. And I just had, you know, two thoughts at the end of seeing this trailer every time, which was like, you know, where did they find this incredible-looking Wolfman? And wait a minute, I didn't see Frankenstein in that at all.
<You know? laughs> Yeah, no kidding, man. Well, that's always one of the funniest things to us was we did that film first because that was kind of his first monster film, his first film really as an actor in the first place. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea, I just absolutely love. I refuse to refer to it by that title because it just drives me crazy. I'll call it the Mark of the Wolfman every time. Yeah.
But, you know, in Germany, and I think there was German money involved in the production of that.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it was made.
But in Germany, whenever they have a monster movie, the monster's name is always Frankenstein in the advertising.
Really?
Yeah. So you see, like, posters for a Godzilla movie, and it's like Frankenstein contra, you know, whatever. Or Gegen. That's what they say in Germany.
Oh, God.
Frankenstein Gegen hetera, you know.
No idea.
So I don't know what it's like in the dubbing. I've never seen a German-dubbed Godzilla film. But no matter what the monster is, it's always Frankenstein in the advertising. So in a way, it's a very Germanic film title from that point of view. But I remembered seeing this amazingly robust and athletic werewolf, you know, who was like everything I always really wanted Lon Chaney to be.
Yeah.
And I could tell that they had great sets, you know, but they weren't really sets. They were locations, actual locations. I could tell just from the spots that this movie had great atmosphere and that it would really deliver. And that was my first exposure to Naschy. I didn't know who it was in that trailer until years later.
Well, did you get to go out and see that film?
I didn't, no.
Well, so did you ever see
one?
We
didn't own a car at that time, and it was only playing at drive-ins.
Did you ever get to see any of his films in what I guess we call first run in the 70s or the 80s?
Actually, I don't believe I did. I never saw I'm pretty sure it was completely a home video discovery for me, aside from the one Nashi film I saw on television, which was Assignment Terror. That was the first Nashi film I saw.
It was Assignment Terror. It was
on commercial television.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So I'm assuming it was a late show, something like that.
Again, it was on the same channel, Channel 19 XIX, and it was commercial interruptions and everything.
What did you think of it then? How old were you when you saw it?
I probably would have been 15, about 15 years old. And I enjoyed it because, I always had the bias toward European films. And so there were a lot of interesting character actors in it, lots of great locations, weird, ooky special effects, and Michael Rennie looking completely lost in the middle of it. And all of these things appealed to me. But particularly, I was fascinated by the very original takes on all of the monsters. I was especially the mummy. I still think it's one of the best mummies I've ever seen in any movie. He looks terribly frail, but at the same time, he's lethal. He looks like he could inflict untold damage on you, but if you managed to get a punch in, he might just wither to dust. But that's not going to happen,
That's not, he's the monster. Yeah. He's going to take care of
it. He's very creepy. The Dracula's very strange, this sort of blue-skinned, Latin lover sort of Dracula who you don't see do much except just sort of stare women, into his power. And then there's Valdemar. He's there. And I made the connection. I saw him. I thought, that's like the werewolf that I saw in those TV spots.
Okay. Well, that had to be... Well, I'm assuming those had to be a couple... The seeing of the film on television and seeing those spots in 71, that had to be at least a couple of years apart.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay.
A couple of years apart. And then there's the Frank Sellin monster, of course, as they called him to elude some mysterious copyright law. The Frank Sellin monster.
Yeah, but you'd have to wonder why. What would be the purpose, considering that somebody somewhere was going to stick Frankenstein in as an alternate title somewhere anyway? I mean. Mm-hmm. Good Lord! Oh, there's no Frankenstein at all in Mark the Werewolf, Frankenstein's Bloody Terror is what it got called.
Mm-hmm. But this was Assignment Terror, and then it got retitled Dracula versus Frankenstein in some places, and it had even stranger titles overseas. The Man Who Came from Umo, right?
I never knew that title. Wow,
that'd be a translation of, I guess, the Italian title.
Oh my.
The Man Who Came from Umo, Planet Umo.
There's a reason we try to start off a discussion of any one of the Nashi films with, okay, here's a title you may have seen it under. This is, that's usually a list this long. So it's a rare thing. We often laugh when we run across one that really only has one or two extra titles. It's like, The Horror Rises from the Tomb. It was pretty much called that or a variation on that with very little change everywhere in the world. We just kind of figured, well, let's see. What's going to connotate a horror faster than horror? Well, they got horror in there. Tomb is in there. That kind of works. What are you going to complain about? So
I always thought Umo was a strange name for a planet. It's like in that movie, the German movie, The Head, there's a Dr. Ood. Like the name Good, but without the G. It's just Ood, If you're born with a name like Ood, you're going to grow up to be a mad scientist.
It's almost a prerequisite. It's predetermined.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how many of what you would call let's focus on the Danensky films.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen most or all of those?
Most.
Which ones stand out as the better ones, or the ones that you think would be fun to return to when you start thinking about his movies in the first place?
Let's see. Well, Mark of the Wolfman.
Okay. Yeah.
Definitely. I think the original cut of that has some extraneous stuff in it. But if you look at the Frankenstein's Bloody Terror cut, it needs
some of it.
Big chunks of that footage back to work. And what immediately followed that?
Assignment Terror.
Okay.
Was produced next.
I've seen that. I've seen Fury of the Wolfman, right, which I think is a lesser one.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess. Nashy despised it.
Yeah. The Werewolf and the Yeti.
Yeah, yeah. Or also known as Night of the Howling Beast.
Night of the Howling Beast. That's the title I saw it under. Dr. Jekyll and the Wolfman.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think has one of Nashy's greatest performances as Mr. Hyde. I think he's one of the really frightening Mr. Hydes. It's right up there with the one in Borachik's Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne. I think that's like one of the most chilling Mr. Hydes. And they were made around the same time. There must have been some zeitgeist going on at the time that produced this really lethal, sparkly-eyed Mr. Hyde.
I think there's something about that story that a lot of creative people can key into because it allows... Well, first of all, it's a juicy thing for any actor to be able to do...
Mm-hmm.
To have those two extremes and to be able to show various shades of it depending on how the script is written, depending on how much nuance is built into it. And so I think for an actor, it's always going to be something they can really get excited about and sink their teeth into. And it does seem to go in waves when people kind of feel like they want to do that, where they want to play with, you know, the dichotomy of man and, you know, that back and forth that goes through everybody's head between the darker thoughts and the altruistic thoughts. I think that's one of the nicer things about the story and why such a slim little volume is almost always going to find new ways to be adapted. I mean, I think there are a lot of films or a lot of stories that are nothing but variations on that, and sometimes I don't even know if the people who wrote those variations are aware that, you know, it's sunk so deeply into the way we think about certain types of stories that I don't even think they're realizing what they're doing sometimes.
Mm.
But I love straight adaptations of it, and I think you're right. The Nashy really it looked like he recognized it for what it was, which is I get to do, you know, not just the Wolfman stuff, but I also get to go a little crazy, but as a madman.
Right, but also something. I don't know how much input he had into the makeup level. Like, if he would talk to the makeup artist and tell them specifically what he wanted, but they gave him these sort of copper-colored contact lenses, and so when he opens his eyes and when he's lying on that table and he's suddenly Mr. Hyde, you look into his eyes and there's nothing human there.
Yeah.
So you know, just from the standpoint of somebody looking at this character in the face, there's no room for negotiation. If he hates you, you're gone.
Yeah, it's a straight line, and it's obvious. It's really neat stuff.
So also, there had always been a streak of sadism that ran throughout all of Nashy's work. And when you get to Mr. Hyde, I mean, that's basically the germinal element in that in the history of horror literature. If you're tracing sadism back to a source, that's where you go, that venting of the sadistic or evil side of human nature.
I guess you're right. Yeah, I hadn't thought about tracing that particular strain of what is just kind of a typical piece of horror storytelling to that, but yeah, I guess you're right.
You know, it does go, you know, obviously to the Marquis de Sade, but in terms of literary horror, because de Sade is philosophy and satire and not strictly horror, but in terms of adapting that, you know, there are things that Mr. Hyde does, like trampling the child in the street. Mm-hmm. You know,
the beating with the cane, and
yeah, mm-hmm.
that's interesting. One of the funnier things, well, it's funny because of the repetition, but we joke constantly in the podcast about, well, where in this film is Nashy going to work the whipping scene into, where somebody gets beaten with a whip?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in every film, but it's pretty close. And so that whole sadistic aspect, that piece, I mean, it works, it flows perfectly in Dr. Jekyll, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, Jekyll just going mad and whipping his, you know, the good side of his character's lover.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's where they were able to work in the nudity as well, or at least a little extra nudity.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you're right about the sadistic part of it. What we've just been calling it is, up, here comes the whipping scene.
Yeah.
Here it comes. So
now, after that, I mean, I saw others too. I may be missing
some. Well, there's Werewolf and the Vampire Women, or Werewolf Shadow.
Oh, yes. I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw it under the title Bloody Moon, which I think was a slightly cut version.
Really?
Or Blood Moon.
On television or on video?
No, it's a videotape. I think it was like a Canadian videotape. It was a big box thing.
Huh.
I still have it. But it was under that title. It was too dark to see. I mean, when you compare it to the DVD that came out,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in the one version, it's almost like you can't quite see the blood. And you look at the DVD and the blood is like everywhere, bright red.
Well, that film is one that a lot of Nashi fans will point to as their favorite, kind of their... Some places you'll see people calling it kind of a sentimental favorite, because for a lot of people, that was because it was shown so often on television as like a midnight movie or a late night movie. Mm-hmm. A lot of people's first encounter with any of Nashi's films was with Werewolf and the Vampire Women, and that's the title they remember it by as well.
Mm-hmm. My feeling about it was a bit different. I remember writing to... Miracle Lipinski, after I saw the DVD of that, I had to revisit it to, I believe I reviewed it. Things get a little fuzzy as time goes on. But I asked Mirik, I said, I know that this is considered like a seminal movie in Nashi's filmography. It was very important. But, you know, looking at it again, I just feel it's weak and inconsistent. And, you know... Do you agree in any way? And you know, he said he didn't agree with me on the whole, but he said he could appreciate what I was saying. And I remember thinking that Gabby Fuchs, the heroine, was just sort of
so
ethereal that she's not quite present.
And, I agree.
And that
I agree.
Is the vampire woman's name of Wandessa?
Vandessa, yeah.
Vandessa. She appears, you know, a bit late in the movie, and then their actual battle, I thought, was almost comical, because it's, you know, this wire work going on, and they're leaping around at each other, and it's just not what I would expect from a sort of formidable character, the way this vampire woman was portrayed up to the time she arose from her coffin. It just seemed a kind of silly thing to make her do once she did it. But it shares that great location with the Blind Dead films,
yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. And
I believe there's if it is those same ruins, I think it may be. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that Mirik told me, he said, is you're looking at this from a different perspective because you've seen so many of the other Nashi films now. But you know, this was like the first movie that really put his vision across completely for many fans, and it's sort of the crystallization of all that's best about Nashi's films for a lot of people. And I think for me, the movie that took that particular pride of place was Count Dracula's Great Love. That's what I think about as the central Nashi film, that or perhaps Mark of the Wolfman. But just to finish answering that question that you asked so long ago, I mean, the other things that I saw, I mean, I did see Lycanthropus.
Oh, I still haven't watched that one myself.
And I saw the one that he made with Fred Olen Ray here in America, if anybody really counts
that one
of the series.
It's
disappointing.
It's up in the air. I haven't watched it yet myself. I've got it, but I haven't put it in the DVD player yet. Yeah.
Lycanthropus, I remember being surprisingly stilted and conservative. I mean, it's almost like he was criticizing horror in general because it hadn't followed his example, and you know, there was a sense of wounded pride throughout the thing, but it also wasn't directed dynamically. And I think that this is one of the recurring problems with his career, which is that it started out so exuberantly with that first movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as the werewolf, he was like bursting out of his shirt. He was like really writhing against the full moon and running on these horrifying rampages, and he interacted with the locations so beautifully. And then as you go on, they become a bit more stilted. The greatest example is in like the Fury of the Wolfman, when you get those clips from Mark of the Wolfman,
and then suddenly
he's all over the screen like a wrestler in werewolf makeup. And then you cut to a shot of him in a different kind of makeup, just walking down the street like a pedestrian.
Well, those shots, they weren't even him.
They weren't him.
No, the director had some stunt man dressed up in the makeup to do what the director wanted him to do. Uh-huh. That's one of the reasons why Nashi was so disappointed. I mean, he described that movie as the first working experience in films that made him cry because mm-hmm. he couldn't get the film made the way he wanted to make it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's a complete mess, and that's one of the reasons. Well, now, two questions, and I'm going to try to keep them in order here, but...
I should also mention I'd never seen the Beast and the Magic Sword.
Oh, well, really?
That's the one I know that I haven't seen. I also saw Howl of the Devil.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that I'm omitting any other films from the werewolf cycle.
Actually including Howl of the Devil and the werewolf cycle, it's really not a Danensky film. It's kind of to the side of it. But well, the first question is, considering how so many Nashi fans hold Werewolf Shadow, a.k.a. Werewolf versus the Vampire Women, in such high esteem, one of the things that Nashi always complained about is he never felt that he had a director, except very rarely, who seemed to have an affinity for the horror genre in the first place and would work with him in such a way that he felt that they were getting everything out of what they had the opportunity to do. And so it's telling that that particular film is the one that he took the opportunity to essentially remake himself as Night of the Werewolf, the one from 1981.
Right.
And that's
was,
the...
It was released under a different title?
Night of the Werewolf? Actually, I don't think so.
Okay.
It's one of the ones that BCI got to put out. It's actually the only Danensky film currently available on Blu-ray.
Oh.
And it's right. Even the Blu-ray's out of print, but it's still easy to get your hands on. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially a remake of Werewolf versus the Vampire Women. A few years back, this has got to be about 5 or 6 years now. I was talked into watching the two films back to back to compare them, and the whole thing about the dynamic direction or the dynamic energy of that character. What's interesting is that Nashi directed Night of the Werewolf, the sort of remake. And so you would think that this would be more true to his vision as how he kind of wanted to do it. But in all honesty, I felt that the werewolf stuff suffered a bit because Nashi had a tendency to kind of get, it seemed to me, a little too enamored with his own bad self in that makeup mm-hmm. and linger too long on the creature itself as it stalked, and therefore the scenes that were built into the film to create tension kind of fizzled occasionally because we're kind of statically watching the beast do things instead of the occasional cutaway to, you know, those great cutaway shots where you get in on the werewolf's face and he's a snarling thing and flecks of drool are coming off as he reacts to things and hears something and turns. Mm-hmm. And there's less of that in the quote-unquote remake. And so it seemed like it's a better film overall because there's higher production values and a lot of neat stuff. There's a lot of nice nuanced stuff in it that just doesn't play or isn't even attempted in the first version. But at the same time, it seemed less vicious. Mm-hmm. The werewolf itself seemed a little less vicious, not because of his actions, but because of the way they're being framed and the way they're being shot. Mm-hmm. So, be interesting to have a group of people actually sit down and watch the films back to back as an exercise and kind of compare and contrast, because it's really the only time you've got him essentially remaking the same story consciously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are elements that come back again and again and again in certain different in certain films. Blue Eyes the Broken Doll, he plays with elements of that story again in Human Beasts, you know, later on in 1980. But the other question, and I realize there's not even a question there.
Yeah. Well, no, I should just mention, I know that I've seen Night of the Werewolf. I reviewed it, I think it's part of that Blu-ray set. But I don't have a clear memory of it at the moment. But there was one where he had really remarkable makeup, and I don't know that I mentioned that one. I think it was released earlier. It may be,
why I said there's really good makeup in that one.
Yeah.
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 Very, very good. It's also very, very good makeup that you haven't seen it. It's going to be interesting to see your reaction when you finally do. The makeup in Beast and the Magic Sword is really good, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had some money to spend. That's one of the Japanese co-productions.
Right.
So they had some money, and it looks really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now I've forgotten whatever the second question was that I was going to try to keep in my head, but it had to do with
another films. Well, you can think of it while I mention this, that from what you were saying before, I think he's an example of an actor who you could point to him as being the auteur of his movies, because he wrote them. I mean, they wouldn't exist if it were not for his passion for the classic Universal films.
That's true.
For example, and up to a point, I think he incorporated his own passion for his own legend. You can see that he became passionate about continuing the Valdemar saga. But even though he was the auteur in terms of like starring in these films and coming up with the ideas and the scripts and everything, he didn't always direct them. But no. And I really do think that the movies stand or fall on the basis of their direction most of the time.
Well, that's why my favorite of his films almost always circle around the four he made with Carlos Allred.
Absolutely.
Har Rises. I mean, he was an excellent director.
Yes.
Har Rises and Vengeance of the Mummy, which when I finally saw Vengeance of the Mummy, I was just stunned by how good the film was. And I guess it's because my first viewing of it, I got to see it widescreen, a good print that wasn't too dark. I could see the detail and the work that went into to what they did with almost every aspect of the film. And those four movies he made with Allred are just amazing. Mm. I mean, just really stunning.
Did he do Dracula's Great Love as well?
No, he did not.
Who was the one who did that?
Javier
Aguirre.
And he made Hunchback.
I liked his work too.
Yeah. Well, he made Hunchback of the Morgue with him as well.
Yeah.
Now that brings me to the question.
So those are the two big directors then, who he worked with.
Leon Klimovsky.
He made more than
a couple of films with Leon Klimovsky as well.
Mm-hmm.
He
had a long career. I mean, I think he had a longer career than either of the other two then.
Yeah, he did. He did. That. Well, Allred was studied under Klimovsky.
Mm-hmm.
Was his assistant director on the first film that Klimovsky made with, the first film they made together, and that's how Allred did his first film as an official director for First Unit,
mm-hmm.
and it went from there. So they had worked together in that capacity before Allred graduated to the director's chair. But you mentioned Count Dracula's Great Love. I remember my question.
Okay.
Count Dracula's Great Love. When Troy and I did a podcast on that particular film, we both had a lot of affection for it. We went back to it, and we were really enthusiastic about it. And then we sat down and we went through the film, and it was so funny because when we got ready to record it, we were kind of looking across at each other, getting ready to do the show, and we try not to kind of give the game away on certain things because we feel it's a little fresher to spring some ideas that have occurred to us in this fresh viewing of the film as we're recording, because then it's a lot fresher, and you never know what connections the other person may make just because it's just a snap thing. But both of us couldn't resist, and it was kind of obvious that both of us had come away a little disappointed with this viewing. And the more we dug into the history of the film, we figured out why we felt the way we did, which is it's a mess of a film. It never really comes together. There's a lot of really good stuff in it. When was the last time you watched it?
3 years ago.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We both were struck by the fact that there are threads in the movie that never come to anything. They just kind of, they appear without anything leading to them, fade away,
mm-hmm.
and are never talked about again. And of course, we found out about what had happened, which was the car accident with the female lead, which had them shut production down completely, go off and completely make another film, Hunchback of the Morgue, and then, when she was able to, come back and finish the movie, which is one of the reasons why there are so many plot elements in Count Dracula's Great Love that come out of nowhere, and then there are things that are at the beginning that don't make any sense because they're never followed through. The whole storyline about that's brought up about Dracula's daughter and this whole bizarre thing about her wanting to breathe life back into her body and all this bizarre stuff, and it goes nowhere. And then he realizes he can't bring her back to life or undeath life or whatever he's supposed to be doing, and goes to get rid of her body, and they drop her body in the river.
Mm.
in the coffin. There's all this bizarre stuff that...
How much of that is due to the English dubbing, though? Have you seen it in another language with subtitles, for example, so you can see what was really going on in the version that they approved?
As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure we had a Spanish version with subtitles, and we had the English dub as well. We always try to find at least two versions of it, if it's possible, to be able to compare the differences, because the English dubs can sometimes really squash some subtleties, to be kind about what they do.
Well, I should explain that whenever I watch a movie and get into it, the first, maybe even the second time as well, I have to go through a movie one or two times before I can start following threads of plot. Mm-hmm. Movies always initially wash over me as just a sort of sensory experience, and if I'm really attentive to anything in particular, it's in the way the camera's moving and how scenes are cut together, how setups are cut together. So I'm very visually preoccupied, much too much to pay attention to nuances of plot, which is probably one reason why European films mean so much to me, because they exist mostly on that level. And if you try to follow a narrative thread through them, you know, you often get, you know, lost in these labyrinths without resolve. I remember a classic example of that, and it's probably due to the same reason, is the horrible Dr. Hitchcock, where there's a key plot point where Dr. Hitchcock is supposed to suddenly explain, you know, why he's doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
And it's not there, and it's because they ran out of time on the set, they were suddenly behind schedule, and the director just plucked 12 pages of script out. Them over his shoulder, and those happen to be the key points of exposition in the screenplay.
Yeah, but I love that movie. I've never felt like there was anything missing. And my most recent viewing was a subtitle of the, I want to say, French dub, French, but it may have been Italian. I can't remember.
No, I was wrong about the doctor's modus operandi. It had to do with the relationship between the housekeeper and Hitchcock's supposedly dead wife.
Oh, okay.
And what was going on between them.
Hmm.
I befriended the screenwriter, Ernesto Gastaldi.
Yeah.
And we did an interview for Video Watchdog, and we continue to swap emails back and forth occasionally. But he told me that story about Ricardo Freire just... horrifying him by pulling out the 12 pages of exposition, and he said, "But people still call it a classic. So what am I going to do?" You know?
Well, I mean, it's a beautiful film when you can finally see a really good print of it, because Lord knows there were enough crappy VHS tapes of it around forever.
But back to Nashi.
Back to Nashi. I'm roving all over the place. Doesn't bother me at all.
Count Dracula's Great Love.
Yeah.
One of the things that appeals to me about that movie immediately, and it's another film I saw initially on commercial television.
Oh.
Same channel, in fact.
It's that may be part of it, too.
It was early exposure to Nashi. Seeing him in a different role. You know, people say he's much too bulky to be playing a vampire.
Count
Chuckula. Yeah. I don't have that problem, because I'm not worried about that. I just know he's an actor in the part, and he's playing the part because he loves this stuff. That doesn't bother me. I'm immediately captivated by that opening sequence. First of all, in the odd voices you get in the dubbing, there's a gravedigger or the guy who's stealing from the castle who sounds like he was dubbed by Warren Oates. That's not a voice you often hear pop up in movies, but he should be doing Westerns, and here he is doing a Spanish horror picture. And then you get the scene where the guy is escaping... from a horror that we don't see, runs up the stairs and has a cleaver slammed into his face, and then he rolls down the stairs,
which is endlessly
slower,
endlessly repeated under the credits
in this loop, which blew the top right off my head when I saw it. You know, and the music kicks in too, and I don't remember the name of the composer, unfortunately, but I still think it's one of the great Euro scores ever. it's a gorgeous piece of writing. But just that opening credit sequence was enough to sort of captivate me and put me in place. Then you get this sort of ridiculous stuff, and I see it's ridiculous about it's the old story of the coach breaking down.
Yeah.
The wagon wheel sort of ridiculously impales the coach driver, so he's out of the story. So the man sort of gallantly takes the ladies to the nearby castle where they meet Dr. Wendell. It is an odd movie.
It's strange.
But it's dreamlike. Well, and once they get inside this house, it's like they become guests of Dr. Wendell's secret libido. You know, he's where he sort of
looking at it.
He has this. You can see that he would almost have like this secret fantasy life in which he's Count Dracula. You know, and he's got these vampire women in his castle. And that's the other thing. I love the way the vampire women would sort of, you know, gallivant through the castle in slow motion in these diaphanous gowns, and they're very fangy. And
one of the neater things is that once you get into that final third of the picture, there are a number of scenes and shots where they've got the three vampire women. And when we covered the film, we were talking about how just take a single image and notice how they've put there's a blonde, mm-hmm. and she's tall, and she's in the front,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the darker haired women are behind her to each side,
mm-hmm.
and the clothing they're wearing is of different hues, and it's just this beautiful image that, I mean, the director honestly shows right there he knew exactly what he was doing by how he positioned these women within the frame,
mm-hmm.
and it's just an absolutely gorgeous thing, and they smile simultaneously and reveal those fangs. It's just this beautiful, I mean, there's a lot of, don't get me wrong, it's not that I don't like Count Dracula's Great Love, but it becomes this, when you start going through and making notes to start discussing how this movie gets from point A to point B and back again, you do start the things that, just watching the film and enjoying it,
mm-hmm.
you let wash over you because of all the great stuff that's in it. But you realize that, wait a minute, this came out of nowhere. What the heck is this? And it is enhanced by one of the all time great ridiculous cat scares where the cat is hurled at an actress. Oh. So that's always a moment where you're taken a little out of the film, going, wow, did they use a catapult or was that just a stagehand slinging that feline? Poor thing.
Yeah.
But
no, I think the women in it are unusually good for an Ashy film. You got Heidi Politoff, who was in Eric Romer's film La Collection News. You got Rosanna Yanni coming back from Mark of the Wolfman.
Yeah,
she's and gorgeous. I don't know the name of the other actress, but you know, I think she's pretty great.
She, she worked with Nashi in a couple of other films. Actually, now her name is completely escaping me. Right now, unfortunately, my brain is filled with images of Emma Cohen that I can't get out of my head from Horror Rises. That's just me. How many of his kind of lesser known horror films, because what we're talking about right now are the Daninsky films, but did you ever get to see, because I don't know if there were ever television screenings of some of these particular films like Inquisition?
Yes, I've seen Inquisition. I first saw it on really crappy Video City VHS.
Oh, really?
Where there was hardly any color left in the image. It was just a really stale looking faded print from some source. So yeah, I saw that.
Well, now that I think about it, the first Nashi film I saw was Night of the Howling Beast, but the second film I saw was the early videotape release, the big clamshell box of House of Psychotic Women, a.k.a. Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll. I still think Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll is just an amazing film. We've talked before. We've talked before about the horrendous score.
Ba-dum.
And it almost just it undermines and destroys so many scenes in the film.
Yeah, great stuff in that movie.
Yeah,
I remember being a bit upset and resentful when I saw an uncut copy within the last few years where there's an animal slaughter.
Oh yeah.
In the movie, I thought there was no need for that. But yeah, I do like the movie. I think whenever Diana Loris shows up in a movie, you're way ahead of the game. You know, another point I wanted to just go back for a moment to Dracula's Great Love and make point about when I saw it on television, because this is a key element in its appeal. I liked that movie so much when I saw it on television, and it was so obviously butchered, you know, for commercial television. Yeah. I'm talking about even when Rossanyani gets staked, you know, on the stairs. I mean, obviously they couldn't do much about the cleaver and the head at the beginning without cutting out the credits of the picture, so they had to leave that intact. But all of the nudity, obviously, was gone. And they were very censorious about violence and bloodshed of any kind in the movie too. So I kept thinking, I've got to see this uncut someday. And it took me a long time to finally see an uncut copy of that. And you know, so it was kind of a thrill when I was finally able to see it uncut.
Well, one of the most fascinating things about Count Dracula's Great Love is that essentially Dracula commits suicide at the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Was that intact?
Nashi's a romantic, you know.
Yeah. Oh well, yeah. And that's one of the great things about the Daninsky films is they allowed that aspect of his character and his storytelling to flower. I mean, that's the main thrust of any of the climaxes of those films, mm-hmm. is that romanticism, that outlook on life.
Right. And I think it runs through his whole career. I mean, it's there in Mark of the Wolfman. You know, it's all about, you know, there's some great love in all of his movies, I think, that I can remember, you know, some doomed relationship. It could be a reincarnated relationship, but there's always something hopeful and idealistic and romantic and tragic at the same time. That he's an unusual example, actually, because there are a lot of filmmakers that specialize in love as a topic.
Hmm.
Not many integrate love and pain to the authentic degree that you find it in real life. It's very rare to find a filmmaker who will allow himself to introduce the subject of pain into a love story. But you can take it for granted in Nashi's work.
True.
You know, it's always there, and it's not an obvious element of his films, because you don't look for things typically on, you know, you just don't look that deeply into movies like this, monster movies, but it's actually there, and it's a rare quality.
Well, I remember a long while back, you and I were talking briefly about Nashi, and you said something that I could not have agreed more with and hadn't heard somebody put into words. We were talking about his autobiography and about how it would have been a very different book in tone if he'd written it just 5 years later, maybe mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years later. Because at the time he wrote that, he was still really disheartened and bitter
mm-hmm.
about the way his career had faltered in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said, as soon as you said that, I thought you really did hit something there that I hadn't thought about, because in the early 2000s, he started to get that recognition. I've never been sure what caused it, what caused that flowering that kind of culminated in the BCI releases over here, where they got their hands on those films and started putting them out, and more special editions started coming out. And I think it started with that German company, Anolis, that did the special edition of Hunchback of the Morgue, and had him over and did a commentary track, and mm-hmm. essentially he started to realize that there was a growing wave of people who wanted to preserve these films, that actually saw them as the pieces, the amazing pieces of the genre that he always felt they were, and it was starting to happen. Mm-hmm. So at the end of his life, and that was something that was really nice to know, is that at the end of his life, the last few years, he was aware that there was this large fan base out there that had never seen it for the first time around. They'd not been there even. Mm-hmm. They're young enough to be his children, and were coming to it. And I really wish he'd been able to have the time to write maybe a second volume that wasn't quite so angry.
A revised edition that wasn't. Well, you know, in some ways, I think I talked about that with Mirek Lipinski also, and it was a friend of Nashi's, and I said, you know, there's this awful sort of bitter, not quite self-loathing, but almost masochistic personality that comes across, and there's somebody who's born to suffer. And he says, well, you know, if you look at his films, you can actually see this in all of his characters, you know? And I think it's part of that romantic personality, that the tragic romantic personality I was just talking about, that's something that was probably unexpressed in his personality when he started out. But as he wrote these stories, and as he found these heroes and villains to embody on screen, he was able to give voice to this unrequited sense in himself. So by the time it came to the point of him writing his autobiography, I think this sort of spilled out. It's like, and so if you look at his career, what is really unrequited? I mean, he had extraordinary opportunities to pursue his obsessions on screen. He made a lot of movies, and they're all very personal pictures from his point of view. And we knew at the time we read those books that they were loved by great numbers of people all over the world. But something in him, I think, don't quite wanted to recognize that, because it would have contradicted everything that he'd expressed in his career. So I think maybe if he had waited, I think he might have been grudging. He would have grudgingly accepted that there was a following, but he would have downplayed it. He still would have denied himself something. He would have denied himself the major reward that he'd been seeking for throughout his entire career, because if he ever ended up with that, it would negate everything he'd ever done.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, I can remember passages in the book and the kind of frustration he felt that, you know, how did I never end up working with this particular Spanish filmmaker? How did we never end up working on a project together?
Right.
And there came a point where you start thinking about all the people who were contemporary Spanish filmmakers with him during his career all along, and they never really ever did connect. I mean, the flimsiest of connections ever with, you know, Juan Simón Picard, and never anything with somebody as prolific as Jess Franco. How do you manage that?
Well, they were rivals.
That's just it. And there's that part of his personality that makes me think that's how that happened. Yeah. That's why.
Well, see, I also think that Franco, just in terms of a matter of temperament, is much more French. I mean, he did most of his work in France.
Yeah,
he happened
to
be born in Spain, but he got out of there because they were too censorious. But I think there's a huge, proud Spanish personality in Nashi, and it would just not... It would give no quarter to any sort of competition from anyone, you know, on his turf. I remember reading an interview with John Gilling, the British director.
Oh, about Cross of the Devil?
About Cross of the Devil.
Yeah.
And he said that Nashi was simply not his idea of a leading man, and it led to problems in their relationship. And I remember there was some film, what was it, The Hanging Woman, right? Which Nashi wrote, but he doesn't play a lead in it. He plays a secondary character in the picture. And I'd have to say, you know, if I had been directing any of this stuff myself, and, you know, I wanted to use one of his scripts, and wasn't really familiar with the breadth of his career or his reputation, I would look at Nashi and I would say, supporting actor.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't say lead actor. He, as a matter of fact, when I look at Mark of the Wolfman, all of that early stuff at the costume ball, where he's sort of marauding around in this quasi Phantom of the Opera Red Death costume, and it was just completely opposed to his build. It's just too flamboyant for someone who's so bulky. What always crosses my mind is he's like a fanboy, you know, dressing up and participating in some sort of a fantasy. But this is another element that runs through his screen persona. There is something there that is every man in fandom who's obsessed with horror you know, obsessed with these characters and wants to play them.
And got to.
Right.
Yeah, he got there.
Right. So, and so they are a sort of step, they're a step removed from classic horror or even from the horror genre itself. They're almost like an emulation of the genre rather than a true piece that generated from it, from its literature. And you can look at Franco's work in the same way, and he would do the same things, although he would take characters or names like Dr. Orloff, which he would take from the Lugosi film, the Human Monster, and he would turn that into a new character. He would take a character like Irena from the Cat People, and he would give that name Irena to a number of people.
Yeah.
Or there would be a countess that turned up. So there were all these allusions to films, you know. So in a way, they're fanish responses to the genre. They're one step removed.
Almost reflections instead of the thing itself, in a way.
And I just recently found out that the French expression for the American expression, one step removed, the American expression, tongue-in-cheek, translates as one step removed. So it's... It's like ironic. So you could say these are tongue-in-cheek treatments of the films, although they're very serious. Nashi's films are very serious.
Oh, yeah.
But in a French sensibility, they're tongue-in-cheek because they are not of the genre, they are about the genre.
See, that's what was a real shock to us just a couple of months ago when we finally saw a subtitled version of El Caminante, which is hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, an intentional black comedy. We did not expect both. It's both high and low comedy. It's like the Canterbury Tales. It's amazing,
mm-hmm.
And it showed. It's almost as if he got to both be very cynical, because it's a very cynical piece, but also really be funny, in very cynically funny. Yes. But also, there's a lot of comedic stuff in it that, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a section of it, there's a sequence in it that plays like a Benny Hill sketch. And it was amazing. That was in 79. It was kind of amazing to see him, at that point late in his career, having been so serious for so long. That's the first film that I'm aware of, anyway, where he has any control. He wrote it, and he directed it, and he's the star, where you're seeing this man intentionally go for the funny bone, and the big shock was that it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't gone deep into a lot of the stuff that comes after that, because then it becomes a little bit harder to get your hands on some of the stuff. I mean, we do have things like Beast of the Magic Sword and Panic Beats and things like that, but those are horror films. But
I've not seen Panic Beats.
Oh, you've not seen Panic Beats?
No. I've seen Crimson.
Yeah, he's just a hired gun on that, and that's a pretty lame little film. But
one of his films, which I haven't seen, which fascinates me, I'd like to have a subtitled copy, is one that he considered maybe his best film. It was called El Huerto del Francés.
Haven't watched that. Was it The Frenchman? Oh darn it! He made it right before El Caminante. Oh, darn it. Now I can't remember the title, but I know what you're talking about.
But I read that, you know, the idea behind the script was that he was always fascinated by the expression leading you down the garden path, and he mm-hmm. decided to investigate it and found out the story about a man who led people, showed them his garden, and then killed them at the end of the path. And he wanted to make a film about that story and how it became a phrase
the Frenchman's
that we all
garden.
Use.
The Frenchman's Garden. That's the English title.
So there actually is an English copy of the film.
I don't know if there's an English dub of it, mm-hmm. but I think that's the translation of the Spanish title, okay. The Frenchman's Garden.
Okay.
Yeah, and it is very highly regarded.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not misremembering this, but I'm pretty sure his son considers that's his, like, his favorite of his dad's films.
Yeah. So I would like to see that, because obviously that comes from an original place. He's not paying homage to something else. So I would like very much to see what Nashi was about as an original idea man.
Well, that's just it. In the 80s, he did a, and these are the ones we haven't gotten our hands on yet, but during that brief span in the early 80s when he was working with that Spanish, I mean, that Japanese producer, he stretched a bit. I still haven't seen, what was it, The Last Kamikaze? Mm-hmm. That one's fairly highly regarded. Mm-hmm. And it, once again, from what I've read of it, that's got nothing to do with anything else that came before it. Mm-hmm. So there, what's great about going through his films one at a time and kind of trying to delve into them is we've still got a number of things there that they're complete mysteries. El Caminante was a complete mystery. And after our initial viewings, Troy and I compared notes just over the phone. We're like, all right, did you expect it to be this damned good? Mm-hmm. He goes, no, this is one of the best things I've ever seen him do in my life. Mm-hmm. And it's completely different from anything else that he's ever done, as far as I can tell. But
you mentioned Vengeance of the Mummy earlier, which I think is a really interesting one.
I love that movie. And it's not just because I'm fascinated with mummies.
No. One thing that stood out for me, though, the last time I saw it, which was the only time I ever saw it in its proper presentation, was there's a scene where the lead, is it Maria Pershing? I think maybe Maria Pershing. There's a scene where she's, like, frightened. She might be in the tomb, and she starts stepping backwards, and she keeps stepping backwards and backwards and backwards. Yeah. And it's like, were they, like, pulling a joke on her, and they forgot to tell her when to stop, and she was waiting for a signal? But you just sort of see this go on for no reason.
Is it that opening scene with her and Jack Taylor in the crypt?
It's not the very opening scene. It comes near the climax.
Oh, near the end. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'd have to go back and look. I can't remember the scene you're talking about.
But I thought for being a low budget picture, obviously it had a really interesting atmosphere to it.
There's a lot of neat stuff.
Jack Taylor in the pith helmet. And,
one of the great things about that was neither Troy or I thought about this until we were actually comparing notes during the podcast and recording, is that the Maria Pershing and Jack Taylor characters, they're like the characters from The Thin Man. They're Nick and Nora of Egyptology. I mean, they are always together, and picking apart this mystery, trying to figure out what's going on, knowing they don't have enough to take to the authorities because it sounds so ridiculous to begin with.
Yeah,
and it was just such a neat dynamic between the two of them as scripted, and it was just so much fun.
Okay, now there you're tapping into a different thing that we should discuss, which is not just that he's like commenting on a horror genre, but when you take something like that, that's almost like a boy's own story version of like Egyptologists and the Mummy.
Yeah.
And you look at these things and they almost have a juvenile streak to them.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get to the nudity, then you get to the sadism, and it's like it has a kind of dreamy quality to it, because it's almost like the subliminal sexuality in pre-adolescence, or it could also be like, these are sort of my juvenile interests, but I'm an adult now,
Well, yeah, but they're not necessarily the quote-unquote adult things. I mean, what kid hasn't tortured ants or killed ants because he doesn't know really what he's doing, or the whole idea of a kid pulling the wings off flies?
Mm-hmm.
And at times, that sadistic streak in those stories almost feels like that aspect of it, like, what can I get away with?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lot of those films' charm, which is that kind of, you're right.
What can I get away with?
What can I get away
now
with?
Now that I'm a filmmaker.
Now that I'm a filmmaker, while playing in that juvenile field. You're right. It is, I mean, come on, we're talking about monster movies to a degree here, so mm-hmm. it appeals to that part of us all.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have those elements of it edited out.
Yeah.
I think there was a question recently where we were talking about with a film like Tombs of the Blind Dead, you find the rape scene in the movie awful and unnecessary and disgusting and deplorable. But at the same time, all the amazing things that are in that movie, do you think that maybe the guy who can pull those amazing things off, it's almost natural that he would have that part of his personality, that they would be inseparable in a way, that he might be able to, as a wiser man, know better than to present that part of his personality as part of an entertainment, but to be able to do the amazing things that he does in that film, in other words, that to be a creator who creates that kind of thing, does that element almost have to coexist to balance it. It's part and parcel of just how you think to begin with.
You're talking about Tombs of the Blind Dead.
Yeah, well, specifically there. Yeah. But, I mean, it could be in what we're talking about as well, where the juvenile aspects of Vengeance of the Mummy, and then the sadistic elements of it as well, the head crushing in that film, those gory head crushings. If you were to take one away, would the other suffer? Would it be less of an effective piece?
Yeah, I don't know. In the case of Tombs of the Blind Dead, I've always been confused because I don't know how much of that rape sequence, for example, is different to us culturally. You know, if it's just like a macho sort of assertion, if it was more acceptable at that time.
That's a good question, too.
The other question is, and it's quite feasible, is that the producer, you know, could have looked at what they had and said, we need more sex in this picture. That's what happened to Jean Roland all the time, and it happened a fair amount of the time to Franco. And you would think that Franco wouldn't mind putting sex in his pictures, but he didn't like putting unnecessary sex in. I mean, he usually had a good reason for it to be there, even if it was excessive when it came about. Mm-hmm. But in that case, it's so gratuitous. It's almost like that the rape sequence in Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, which I think is really well integrated.
Oh yeah,
and very well staged. But everyone who was involved in that film told the same story about how the producer just said, "We need some sex in this picture, so you know, let's have a rape sequence here." And so they had to basically put it together overnight to appease the producer, and that very well could have happened in that case.
It's possible. I wonder, but I mean, the thing is, I mean, you have a rape sequence that's not nearly as harsh pop up in the third Blind Dead film too.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you could still be talking about the same pressure from producers in that film as well.
But. Yeah, but you can actually find American films made during that same time period, early 70s, where rape was still being joked about.
Oh yeah, well, or rapes were just, I mean, there seemed to be a, this is something.
Jackson Tim, County Jail, for heaven's sake. Yeah. I mean, it was much more.
This is something Troy thought about and put forth when we started talking about this kind of thing, the where rapes popped up, and they popped up in a lot of early to mid-70s films. And Troy put forth the possible thought that, hey, is this some kind of reaction against what was going on in the world at the time, which was the fight for equal rights, the push from women to have the same, you know, have the same pay, have the ability to do the same, you know, in different countries. I mean, I remember it when I was a kid here in the States, but it was going on elsewhere as well. Was that a kind of reaction? I mean, you have the coming together of the rating system, and therefore a lot of censorship dropping away.
Mm-hmm.
And was it, you know, was this happening as a reaction to this kind of thing? And you start to look at the...
So a sort of, because these movies are primarily male fantasies anyway.
Yeah.
Incorporate the male fantasy of getting even with the woman for daring to usurp
the male position
in society. Yeah,
show her
her place,
and he wouldn't be the first one to think of that either. I mean, there have been books written on the subject,
but. Right? Yeah, but that could be. There's a lot going on then.
When you think about, I always think about this. Obviously, the 1970s are the really fertile ground for Nashi's career. When he produced the most number of movies, and where he really seemed to be able to get what he wanted on screen. With, you know, there were problems here and there. That's true of anybody, especially if you're talking about a period that essentially starts in '69 when Mark of the Wolfman was filmed, and really kind of comes to a halt when money starts to dry up for a lot of European productions by '78, '79, '80. That period of time, when you look at those films he produced in that decade, what do you kind of think of as the takeaway for today? I mean, when you look back at those movies, do you see influence in what's being done today by anybody? Do you see it as just the next building block, an obvious outgrowth of what the '60s brought and where things went, just as censorship became less and less? And you were able to do, you know, they were able to do the clothed version and the nude version and have, you know, the export version that they could get a little racier with.
Right.
When you look back at that decade of his work, what's the impression today about looking at it as...
Well, the one thing I think it's important to notice is if there had been no Paul Nashe in the 1970s. And you have to remember, too, that there was like a big dearth of werewolf movies in America.
True.
During that period. There was The Boy Who Cried Werewolf. But before that, I don't think there was a werewolf film from a major studio since maybe Cry of the Werewolf from Columbia in the 1940s.
44? Wow.
Oh, well, I'm overlooking things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf that came out from the Independence. But and, maybe... Yeah. I just remember there being a big period of time when there hadn't been a werewolf film that came out in a while. And in the 70s, we got, in English, I would say we had the one I mentioned, and then there was also Legend of the Werewolf that came from England, and The Beast Must Die, which I really don't like these movies, Boy Who Cried Werewolf. I mean, they don't add anything to the filmography of lycanthropy in any meaningful way. But Nashe was doing that. But if you look at what was happening in the history of American cinema in terms of lycanthropy, the last really important thing was maybe the teenage werewolv.
Yeah.
And Lon Chaney before that. So Nashe is an evolutionary stage unto himself. And you know, you go from that to Benicio del Toro's Wolfman. Hmm. And I don't think you could have that Wolfman without what Nashe did.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
Oh, I'm overlooking also Oliver Reed, Curse of the Werewolf. Very important. And I'm sure that was a huge, that must have been a huge influence on Nashe's visualization of Valdemar. But the main difference being that Terence Fisher didn't do much more than give us little glimpses and suggested the power of that creature. And Nashe actually lets us revel in that power.
Yeah, I've always felt I love Curse of the Werewolf. I think it's a great film. Mm-hmm. But I've always felt it's so odd that half the movie goes by before we even get to Oliver Reed. Mm-hmm. And then we have to wait a little bit longer before we get to the werewolf. Mm-hmm. And there's always a part of me that thinks, wow, there should be a 15-minute long, a version of the film that's 15 minutes longer where we get like more werewolf rampaging. Because what little we see is great, that whole shaking of shaking of the bars and tearing the bars loose in that jail cell and things of that nature. But I think
Terence Fisher was a much artier director than people give him credit for, at least in terms of how he... what he chose not to do. I mean, he didn't often take the usual course with his movies. I mean, even with starting with Revenge of Frankenstein, that's certainly not your traditional Frankenstein story. What you're saying, he's sort of thwarting your expectations of what you should get from a werewolf picture.
Well, he just certainly leaves you wanting more. You
know? He certainly did that with Phantom of the Opera, which I find a really interesting movie.
I do too.
But he had a very strange approach to storytelling. And certainly he had a very sort of planted camera, you know, look where he let the actors walk in the scene. He was a little more theatrically based.
I think that's why some of my favorite Fisher films, because of his, that whole idea of the planted camera and letting the actors do the movement, I think that's one of the reasons why Cushing was the perfect actor for him to have center stage, because Cushing always wanted to have some kind of, some little bit of business, some prop to play with, something to do within the scene.
And a very Victorian personality as well, and I think that there's something about that Fisher was more of a 19th century filmmaker than a 20th century filmmaker. But still, in terms of the stories, and of course some of this may have come from the screenwriters who were involved, but and the classic example of this is The Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll, which is a completely subversive retelling of that story.
I was shocked when I finally got to see that movie about a year and a half ago. It was, first of all, how it's really good, and how looking at it and how overt some things are in it, and being surprised that they thought they were going to get away with this.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Right.
But
my point in answer to your question is that Nashe was doing the werewolf thing his own way for a big chunk of time when no one in America or Britain were doing it.
Yeah.
He kept it alive and he kept it evolving. So I think if you take what was done in the recent version of The Wolfman with Del Toro, and you take it back to what was done in American or British terms last with The Werewolf, and you'd have to go back to things before Nashi. I'm not talking about things that followed Nashi, like yeah. American Werewolf in London or The Howling. You know, you see that it becomes a much more lethal, animalistic thing, you know, very athletic.
Yeah.
And they also play up this tragic romantic element, which you can see in also in Coppola's Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, actually, you could look at Coppola's Dracula and say that it has that same Nashian element of tragic love that you really don't get from other Dracula pictures. So you could say, I don't know if Coppola is, if he's familiar with Nashi's work or if he is, but they have these shared elements.
I'd love to get the chance to ask him.
You know, or the screenwriter, perhaps.
Yeah, James Hart, you may be right. Mm-hmm. As you were talking about Nashi kind of being, during the 70s, he really kind of was the only guy that I'm aware of he definitely was the only guy consistently making werewolf pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's possible to see American Werewolf in London, the 1-2 punch of American Werewolf in London and The Howling kind of being the American punch at the end of that decade that maybe those led to, in a way. Not all of them were seen over here, but it's not as if they weren't seen. I mean, those English dub things were playing at drive-ins for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And American Werewolf and The Howling were the first big screen werewolf films produced by Hollywood, as you were saying, probably since the late 50s. Mm-hmm. I can't think of another werewolf film. I mean, Hammer's one film in 1962,
mm-hmm.
but that's a British production, so
yeah.
In a way that doesn't fit the category I'm talking about.
I'm just thinking that, you know, of course, in those years, we were younger, and so time was a lot more significant.
Okay,
but
right.
I can remember interviewing Joe Dante when The Howling came out in 1980. And he observed that there had not been a significant werewolf movie made in English since probably Curse of the Werewolf.
Yeah.
And so that's the difference between 1961 and 1980. That's like a 20-year period. It's a long time for a significant movie monster to not be on screen. And certainly Hammer was cranking out Frankenstein movies all that time.
Oh, yeah.
Dracula movies were being done everywhere.
It's I always joke that my heart lies with the Mummy movies just because they get absolutely no respect, and that may be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the werewolf has gotten even less respect than that in some ways, because
maybe it's a more difficult makeup to pull
off.
Yeah,
it's the physicality of it that's harder to do, maybe. Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking in the back of my mind about, you know, you could compare Nashi to someone like Bob Burns and his Kogar the gorilla. You know, because he's played Kogar as Kogar and Kogar as Tracy the gorilla on Ghostbusters. and he's, you know, like a brawny guy, you know, who gets into this hairy costume and becomes that character when he puts it on. He's very protective about it.
Yeah,
You know, I'm not saying that you can find a Bob Burns filmography. filled with tragic romance, but there's some shared element there about a fan, you know, and Bob loved seeing gorilla actors in movies when he was a kid and said I want to grow up and do that. I want to be a gorilla in movies, and he did it. So there is a parallel there.
I think there really is. It's another instance of that thing of it being a reflection of that thing that you love. In other words, I can't really be that thing I love, but I can be a reflection of it and therefore maybe become something that can be comparable.
Right.
So,
and I really think that that's one reason why Nashi's fans are so passionate about it, because they see a reflection of themselves in
Nash. Oh, he's one of us. Yeah. I mean, this guy loved those movies. He talked endlessly. I mean, we kind of one of the reoccurring jokes in the podcast is about how, well, two of them. One, it always goes back to Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, that film that sparked his imagination when mm-hmm. he was a kid. And, well, also, you know, how many women is he going to sleep with in the picture? Mm-hmm. But also that it's all those movies, it's those Universal and Hammer movies that he was such a fan of that made him want to do this in the first place. That's what caused him to write that first script long before he was ever going to be in the movies themselves. He wrote the script out of being a fan of this stuff. So
I was always impressed by the story that he tells in his autobiography about how he took his wife on their honeymoon to see Mask of Satan. You know, Black Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
So she knew what she was in for right away.
She had to know. You know, she had to.
But you can see things that he takes from Black Sunday in his films. I mean, the Wandessa character in Werewolf and the Vampire Woman is mm-hmm. more Barbara Steele than you know, Gloria Holden or some other earlier
female
vampire. And Patty Shepard, who plays her, is like a Barbara Steele lookalike to some extent.
It's true. One film I wanted to touch on, it's one we haven't covered in the podcast, and we just do this briefly because I don't even know that you probably have seen it, but he didn't write the film. But it's one that I just wish that more people knew because it's a Klimovsky film, and it's The People Who Own the Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Did you...
I have seen it.
Did you catch it on television? Or did you
videotape?
On videotape?
Yeah, I think it was called a Star Video.
Okay.
It was one of these cheap budget releases. That's how I saw it.
I remember watching it and being absolutely stunned because I didn't know that the film was going to be a kind of apocalyptic tale.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, we're going to have a wallow in, you know, rich people being decadent.
And yeah. I had seen TV spots for that too.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that Nashi was in it or who Nashi was at the time. But I used to see a lot of TV spots for that film when it was playing the local drive-in areas, and so it was something I reached for when I saw it on VHS. And I it's been a long time since I've watched it, so I can't comment on it knowledgeably, but I do remember being favorably impressed with it.
I remember being really surprised when I found, I think it's French poster art for it, and realizing that the title for it there was The Last Desire.
Mm-hmm.
And thought, oh, that doesn't really fit. And then going, 1, 2, 3. Oh, wait a minute, actually, it kind of does.
Yeah, I don't recall.
All right, well, I guess we can probably wrap it up unless there's something else you want to touch on. I think we're
we didn't discuss Horror Rises from the Tomb.
No, we didn't, but then again, I got the feeling that probably maybe we'll probably do another one of these the future.
Okay.
Because the desire to touch on even, you know, specific bigger films, just it'd be great, but at the same time, I mean, I think we've been talking an hour now, so. Yeah.
Well, short, I think it's one of the great zombie movies, and
really?
Yeah, I do. I think I'm really impressed with it each time I see it. I've seen that one about 3 times. And, you know, I originally saw it on television also, cut to hell.
Hmm.
And when I finally saw it, it was, you know, much more powerful film. And, you know, I always like that one a good deal.
I loved delving into Horror Rises from the Tomb because it is one of his films that I think it rewards repeat viewings because there are all these strange little things in it that you let drift by you on initial viewing, or maybe even the second or third viewing, but then it sticks maybe that second or third time. It's like, wow, that's really kind of an odd element. For instance, instead of a crucifix, they have those crossed hammers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, where does that come from? What's that about? Was he just trying to avoid using a crucifix? Was there some reason for that particular thing? And there are all kinds of things like that in the movie that none of them detract. It's none of them seem like they don't need to be there and are extraneous, but they work just fine. And then the more you look at them over and over again, you're like, well, there's something about that that keeps drawing my attention. Why is that there? But yeah, I think it's a great movie.
Okay, well, we'll discuss that one next time.
Okay, we'll talk about that one
next time. I'll revisit it also so I can talk about it.
Oh, it's neat.
All right. And you see what happens, ladies and gentlemen, when I'm not in the room.
Yes, yes.
Very, very smooth ending there, right? I love the way you wrapped it all up there.
I just pushed stop on the machine and it blew up. I don't understand. No one told me you weren't supposed to, you know, drop water on this thing.
So
yes,
that unceremoniously brings us to the end of our first interview with Tim Lucas. Hope you enjoyed it.
As we said at the beginning, we'll probably have another interview with him later in the year.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll start with Horror Rises from a Tomb instead of ending with it. I find it very, very interesting statement he makes there about it. He's seeing it as a great zombie film.
I know,
which I've never thought of it as.
Because I would just think of that as one small ingredient of the hundreds of ingredients that are thrown into this, you know, this film. So agreed. Yeah, that's interesting that it really stood out that much to him as a great zombie movie.
Yeah, I can't wait to. I stopped myself then because I was under a bit of time pressure. I stopped myself then because I knew if I asked him that question, he started talking, then I would have just set my stupid ass back down and probably missed my opportunity to do something else. So. Mm-hmm. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, you can get back. You can get in touch with us through by email. I'll learn how to speak again very soon. NashyCast@gmail.com. Drop us a line. Glad you're enjoying things, because if you've stuck through this far, surely to God you're enjoying it. I don't think anybody's sitting there going, "Oh my God, this is killing me," and still haven't pushed stop on this thing.
Yeah, some people don't push stop as quickly as other people do, Rod. But
yes, we circled back around there to find a little. Yes, that's the salt you shoved in the way. All right. Get in touch with us if you've got an idea for us. If you've got some criticisms. If you've got some. If you just want to poke fun at me for not being able to handle digital machinery well. Drop us a line at nashycast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time for episode 19. That would be Exorcism. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we're back to using last names. We'll see you next time.
lágrimas me están secando con mi pistola y mi corazón. Y aquí siempre paso la vida con la pistola y el corazón.